Hi, I'm David Berceau, and today we're going to be talking about the Gospel of Judas. In the spring of 2006, many newspapers featured headlines declaring, "A new gospel has been found, the Gospel of Judas." National Geographic magazine did its May 2006 cover article on this newly found work called the Gospel of Judas. In its featured article, the magazine declared, "The Gospel of Judas gives us a different view of the relationship between Jesus and Judas, offering new insights into the disciple who betrayed Jesus." One website said this about the newly discovered manuscript: "The appearance of the Gospel of Judas will rank among the greatest finds from Christian antiquity and is without doubt the most important archaeological discovery of the past 60 years. What will make this gospel famous or infamous, perhaps, is that it portrays Judas quite differently from anything we previously knew. Here he is, not the evil, corrupt, devil-inspired follower of Jesus who betrayed his master. He is instead Jesus' closest intimate and friend, the one who understood Jesus better than anyone else, who turned Jesus over to the authorities because Jesus wanted him to do so. This gospel has a completely different understanding of God, the world, Christ, salvation, human existence, not to mention of Judas himself, than came to be embodied in the Christian creeds and canon. It will open up new vistas for understanding Jesus and the religious movement he founded." Really? Well, let me tell you the truth about the so-called Gospel of Judas. To begin with, early church scholars have known about the so-called Gospel of Judas for well over 1,800 years. That's because Irenaeus, an early Christian overseer or bishop, wrote a history of all the heresies that were around in his day. In his work, which is entitled Against Heresies, and was written around the year 170 or 180, Irenaeus tells us about a Gnostic group known as the Cainites. And he says this about them: "Others again declare that Cain derived his being from the power above and acknowledge that Esau, Korah, the Sodomites, and all such persons are related to themselves. On this account, they add, they've been assailed by the Creator. They declare that Judas the traitor was thoroughly acquainted with these things, and that he alone, knowing the truth as no others did, accomplished the mystery of the betrayal. By him all things, both earthly and heavenly, were thus thrown into confusion. They produce a fictitious history of this kind, which they call the Gospel of Judas." Now, until recently we had no copy of this so-called Gospel of Judas, but we knew of its existence from Irenaeus' account, and we knew that it was not a first-century writing. Rather, it was well known that it was one of the many fake gospels that the Gnostics were churning out in the 2nd century. And we knew that it was a work produced by this Gnostic group known as the Cainites. And basically, they taught that all of the villains in the Bible, beginning with Cain himself, Esau, Korah, the Sodomites, etc., and Judas, they were actually the real heroes because they understood what was really going on. So the discovery of a manuscript containing the Gnostic Gospel of Judas is hardly a newsworthy event, except perhaps to persons who study Gnosticism. To call it the most important archaeological discovery of the past 60 years is not only intellectually dishonest, it's absolutely absurd. Interestingly, after telling us about the Gospel of Judas, Irenaeus went on to say about the Cainites and the Gnostics in general, "They have now been fully exposed, and simply to exhibit their sentiments is to obtain a victory over them, for it will not take many words to overturn their system of doctrine once it has been made public to all." Which is the very thing he did in his lengthy treatise. He laid out what all of these different groups believed. And what he said still stands true. merely to display what the Gnostics taught, and the Cainites in particular, is enough to overturn them. I dare say that the scholars who have brought forth this Gospel of Judas with such fanfare don't believe a word of it themselves. The best way to show you how insignificant the so-called Gospel of Judas truly is merely to read it to you. It's a fairly short work, nothing like the four canonical Gospels, and it consists merely of a few supposed conversations that Jesus had with the 12 and with Judas. Now, what I'm about to read to you is actually an abridged version of the Gospel of Judas. The persons who translated it were only able to translate about 80% of it because of the very poor condition of the manuscript. But the missing 20% isn't in one place. It's spread throughout the manuscript. As a result, there are several sections of the manuscript that are almost unintelligible because of so many missing words and sentences. Anyway, here's what it says. When Jesus appeared on earth, he performed miracles and great wonders for the salvation of humanity. And since some walked in the way of righteousness while others walked in their transgressions, the 12 disciples were called. He began to speak with them about the mysteries beyond the world and what would take place at the end. Often he did not appear to his disciples as himself, but he was found among them as a child. One day he was with his disciples in Judea, and he found them gathered together and seated in pious observance, and offering a prayer of thanksgiving over the bread. And Jesus laughed. The disciples said to him, "Master, why are you laughing at our prayer of thanksgiving? We have done what is right." He answered and said to them, "I am not laughing at you. You are not doing this because of your own will, but because it is through this that your God will be praised." They said, "Master, you are the Son of God." Jesus said to them, "How do you know me? Truly I say to you, no generation of the people that are among you will ever know me." When his disciples heard this, they started getting angry and infuriated and began blaspheming against Jesus in their hearts. When Jesus observed their lack of understanding, he said to them, "Why has this agitation led you to anger? Your God who is within you has provoked you to anger within your souls. Let any one of you who is strong enough among human beings bring out the perfect human and stand before my face." They all said, "We have the strength." But their spirits did not dare to stand before him except for Judas Iscariot. He was able to stand before him, but he could not look him in the eyes, and he turned his face away. Judas said to him, "I know who you are and where you have come from. You are from the immortal realm of Barbalo, and I am not worthy to utter the name of the one who has sent you." Knowing that Judas was reflecting upon something that was exalted, Jesus said to him, "Step away from the others, and I shall tell you the mysteries of the kingdom. It is possible for you to reach it, but you will grieve a great deal. For someone else will replace you, in order that the 12 disciples may again come to completion with their God." At this point, there seems to be some parts missing of the manuscript. We pick up again with the disciples having seen a vision, and they're telling it to Jesus. It says, "They said, 'We have seen a great house with a large altar in it and 12 men. They are the priests, we would say, and a name, and a crowd of people is waiting at the altar until the priests receive the offerings. But we kept waiting.' Jesus said, 'What are the priests like?' They said, 'Some sacrifice their own children, others their wives. Some sleep with men. Some are involved in slaughter. Some commit a multitude of sins and deeds of lawlessness. And the men who stand before the altar invoke your name. And in all the deeds of their deficiency, the sacrifices are brought to completion.' After they said this, they were quiet, for they were troubled. Jesus said to them, 'Why are you troubled? Truly I say to you, all the priests who stand before that altar invoke my name. Again I say to you, my name has been written on this, and there's a blank there, of the generations of the stars through the human generations, and they have planted trees without fruit in my name in a shameful manner. Jesus went on to tell them, those you have seen receiving the offerings at the altar, that is who you are. That is the God you serve, and you are those 12 men you have seen. The cattle you have seen brought for sacrifice are the many people you lead astray before that altar. There's another missing part of the manuscripts. It referring to someone says, will stand and make use of my name in this way, and generations of the pious will remain loyal to him. After him, another man will stand there from the fornicators, and another will stand there from the slayers of children, and another from those who sleep with men, and those who abstain, and the rest of the people of pollution and lawlessness and error, and those who say, we are like angels. They are the stars that bring everything to its conclusion. For to the human generations it has been said, look, God has received your sacrifice from the hands of a priest, that is, a minister of error. But it is the Lord of the universe, who commands, on the last day they will be put to shame. All right, then we move to a conversation between Jesus and Judas by himself. It says, Jesus said, come, that I may teach you about secrets no person has ever seen. For there exists a great and boundless realm, whose extent no generation of angels has seen, in which there is a great invisible spirit, which no eye of an angel has ever seen, no thought of the heart has ever comprehended, and it was never called by any name. And a luminous cloud appeared there. He said, let an angel come into being as my attendant. A great angel, the enlightened, divine, self-generated, emerged from the cloud. Because of him, four other angels came into being from another cloud, and they became attendants for the angelic, self-generated. The self-generated said, let something that's missing there come into being, and it came into being. And he created the first luminary to reign over him. He said, let angels come into being to serve him. And myriads without number came into being. He said, let an enlightened aeon, and aeon is a term that's used a lot by the Gnostics. It's in Greek, A-E-O-N. Anyway, he said, let an enlightened aeon come into being, and he came into being. He created the second luminary to reign over him, together with myriads of angels without number to offer service. That is how he created the rest of the enlightened aeons. He made them reign over them, and he created them myriads of angels without number to assist them. Now, if you're having trouble following this, don't worry. There's not going to be an exam at the end of it. And I'm reading through these rather tedious and absurd details just to expose how ridiculous this supposed gospel is. Anyway, it goes on to say, Adamas was in the first luminous cloud that no angel has ever seen among all those who are called God. He made the incorruptible generation of Seth appear. He made 72 luminaries appear in the incorruptible generation in accordance with the will of the Spirit. The 72 luminaries themselves made 360 luminaries appear in the incorruptible generation in accordance with the will of the Spirit, that their number should be 5 for each. The 12 aeons of the 12 luminaries constitute their father, with 6 heavens for each aeon, so that there are 72 heavens for the 72 luminaries, and for each of them 5 firmaments, for a total of 360 firmaments. They were given authority and a great host of angels without number for glory and adoration. And after that also virgin spirits for glory and adoration of all the aeons and the heavens and their firmaments. The multitude of those immortals is called the cosmos, that is, perdition, by the Father and the 72 luminaries, who are with the self-generated and his 72 aeons. In him the first human appeared with his incorruptible powers, and the aeon that appeared with his generation, the aeon in whom are the cloud of knowledge and the angel, is called, and then it's missing whatever he was called. And look, From the cloud there appeared an angel whose face flashed with fire and whose appearance was defiled with blood. His name was Nebro, which means rebel. Others call him Yaldabaoth. Another angel, Soclus, also came from the cloud. So Nebro created 6 angels, as well as Soclus, to be assistants, and these produced 12 angels in the heavens, with each one receiving a portion of the heavens. Now again, don't worry if you're not getting these details. I'm wanting you to just see the absurdity of this work. It's just as Irenaeus said, the easiest way to overturn it is just to expose what it actually says. Okay, the account goes on to say, "Then Soclus said to his angels, 'Let us create a human being after the likeness and after the image.' They fashioned Adam and his wife Eve, who is called in the cloud Zoe. For by this name all the generations seek the man, and each of them calls the woman by these names." After that, Jesus laughed. Judas said, "Master, why are you laughing?" Jesus answered and said, "I am not laughing at you, but at the error of the stars. Because these 6 stars wander about with these 5 combatants, and they all will be destroyed along with their creatures. But you," talking to Judas, "will exceed all of them, for you will sacrifice the man that clothes me." And let me explain that last sentence to you. In Gnostic theology, Christ never became a human, because all humans are the creation of an inferior God. So he either took on the appearance of a body, which wasn't real, or in some of their stories, like in this one, he actually possessed a real human named Jesus. And that's what he means by the man that clothes me, that Christ is speaking, but he's possessing the body of this man named Jesus. He continues on speaking to Judas, "Already your horn has been raised, your wrath has been kindled, your star has shone brightly. Look, you have been told everything. Lift up your eyes and look at the cloud and the light within it and the stars surrounding it. The star that leads the way is your star." Judas lifted up his eyes and saw the luminous cloud, and he entered it. And here the gospel abruptly changes subjects, and it concludes with this. Their high priest murmured because Jesus had gone into the guest room for his prayer. But some scribes were there watching carefully in order to arrest him during the prayer, for they were afraid of the people, since he was regarded by all as a prophet. They approached Judas and said to him, "What are you doing here? You are Jesus' disciple." Judas answered them as they wish, and he received some money and handed Jesus over to them. And that's the end. Well, are you impressed? I doubt it. Do you see why I previously said that I feel quite certain that the very persons who are promoting the gospel of Judas do not believe a single word of it themselves? I mean, after all, do you find yourself attracted to the Jesus of the gospel of Judas? Is he anything like the Jesus of the real gospels? Not at all. He's arrogant, always laughing at his disciples. He's not at all the embodiment of love that we see in the real Jesus. And isn't it quite dishonest for National Geographic to say that this work gives us, quote, new insight into Judas? What a joke! New insight? It gives new insight only if you were to believe the gospel of Judas. But is there a soul alive on earth who believes it? I truly doubt it. Now, don't feel bad if you had trouble following some of the parts of this fake gospel. I had to read it over several times myself to grasp what it was saying, and even then it's still pretty murky to me. But the Gospel of Judas is a good example of the mythical cosmology that the various Gnostic teachers taught. So I want to just briefly give you a summary of the general Gnostic school of thought, and then we'll talk about how the Cainites varied the general scheme just a little bit. Most of the Gnostics taught that in the beginning there was an ultimate, indescribable deity known as the Father. He dwells in the ultimate heavens called the Pleroma by most of the Gnostics, which means fullness. Now there in the Pleroma, there's no evil, there's no passions, there's no physical matter. There were, however, other divine beings beside the Father. In the Gospel of Judas, it talks about these various aeons. Okay, in all of the Gnostic legends, there was a fall from this perfect divine universe. One of the youngest of the divine beings, Sophia, wants to give birth to a being apart from the ultimate Father. So she cohabits with one of the other divine beings and eventually gives birth to a dark creature with beast-like features. However, he is soon cast out of the Pleroma, either by Sophia herself, who wants to hide this creature she's produced from the others, or by the Father. Now, the creature that she produced wanted to imitate the real Father, so he began creating the material world. Now, in most of the Gnostic myths, he's usually called the Demiurge, which literally means worker of the people. But he can be equated with our English word creator. The Cainites, they said that the Demiurge actually has a name, which is Hystera. Anyway, the Demiurge creates an entire universe that's an imitation of the heavenly universe. But his world is physical, unlike the Pleroma. Furthermore, it contains the seeds of evil, discord, and death. Being imperfect himself, he cannot create something better than what he is. So everything physical is ultimately corrupt, and human flesh is totally depraved. Well, the Demiurge has done everything he can in his power to keep Adam and Eve and their offspring from knowing their true origin. In the Bible, the Demiurge calls himself Yahweh or Jehovah, and he boasts that he alone is God. He's the God of the Old Testament, and he is the God that the 12 apostles, or I should say the 11, were following, and why Jesus was laughing about the God they were sacrificing to and praying to. And only Judas catches on that, oh, they're serving this Demiurge instead of the true Father. Now, as I said, the Cainites who produced the Gospel of Judas had different names for these various mythological beings. But in general, their beliefs followed the same basic story. Like many of the other Gnostic groups, the Cainites taught that all of the villains in the scriptures are really the good guys. They are portrayed as villains by the Demiurge because they've discovered the truth about things and they no longer will serve him. So therefore, he tries to punish them. So the divine being who worked through the serpent was really a hero. He or she was trying to help Adam and Eve to know the real truth about things. The Cainites said that Cain discovered the truth of things, so the Demiurge has painted him out to be a murderer so that no one else would follow him. And you can go through the scriptures, whether it's the Sodomites, Esau versus Jacob. Every time, the one who is portrayed as the villain is really the one who understands the true God, and Yahweh is mad at him because he will not serve Yahweh. Anyway, according to the Cainites, Jesus came to earth to reveal to mankind this sacred knowledge, or gnosis, which is where we get the word Gnostic. Because without this revealed knowledge, humans cannot be saved. But apparently Jesus wasn't able to get this information across to his 12 disciples except for Judas. Judas grasped these things the other apostles didn't. So they ended up misleading everyone through their ministry. However, Judas secretly revealed the things he learned to a few other persons who were worthy to hear it, and they have kept this seed of truth alive. That's the story of the Cainites. In short, the Cainite system was a system of salvation by knowledge, knowing the truth about things, knowing what's really going on in the universe. But there's even more to them than that. Irenaeus went on to say about them, he writes, "I have also made a collection of their writings in which they advocate the abolition of the doings of Hystera. Moreover, they call this Hystera the creator of heaven and earth. They also hold, like Carpocrates, that men cannot be saved until they have gone through all kinds of experience. An angel, they maintain, attends them in every one of their sinful and abominable actions and urges them to venture on audacity and incur pollution. Whatever may be the nature of the action, they declare that they do it in the name of the angel, saying, O angel, I use your work. O great power, I accomplish your operation. And they maintain that this is perfect knowledge. Yet as convenient and appealing as the Cainite doctrine was, they never attracted a very large following, mainly because even the carnal found their teachings a little hard to believe. So I have to ask the question, why all the hype about this document? Why would the poorly written work of a small Gnostic sect generate so much interest and publicity? Well, at first glance, it doesn't make any sense. But on reflection, the reason becomes very obvious. And that is simply to disparage Christianity and to confuse the public about the nature of Christ and what he truly taught. In the summer of 1999, I was invited to attend the conference of the International Patristic Society, which was being held at Oxford University in England. Now, patristics is the study of the church fathers or of early Christianity. And so this was a conference of various scholars and other persons who study early Christianity and who are interested in the subject. I was really looking forward to being around a lot of other people who've studied the early church to be able to exchange ideas and interact with and all of that. And I have to admit, it was fun being able to stay at Oxford. We were allowed to stay in the dorms there that weren't being used. And we ate in one of the Oxford dining halls, which dated back to the time of the Reformation, if not earlier. But once I began mingling with the other delegates at the conference, I became quite disappointed. I met very few people who seemed to have any kind of relationship with Christ. I remember one night at supper, I was sitting next to a professor from Norway, and we were engaged in conversation. And in the middle of it, I decided to ask him, tell me, do you think most of the delegates here consider themselves to be Christians? And he reflected for a moment, and then he said, no, I wouldn't think so. In other words, their only interest in the early church was to study it the same way somebody else would study Grecian vases or something like that. The papers that were presented during the sessions of the conference were even more disappointing. They tended to focus on some extremely trivial matter, and someone would talk a half an hour or an hour on something that I couldn't care less about, nor should anyone else. A man from Japan read a paper prepared by some woman concerning the statue of the early Christian writer Hippolytus. Now, scholars have surmised for many centuries that the statue of Hippolytus is actually a composite, that it was originally the statue of somebody else, and they simply removed the head from the statue and placed a sculpture of the head of Hippolytus on the body that was there. Anyway, this paper was arguing that the body was actually the body of a woman, not of a man. Now, I've seen some pretty close-up pictures of the statue, and the build and the various characteristics of the body are that of a man, not of a woman. But here's some woman, perhaps a professor somewhere, had written this long, lengthy paper trying to prove what was an absurd point, and in the end, who cares? What difference does it make? But the thing that bothered me the most was the keynote address from the then presiding president of the International Patristic Society. For years, the president or chairman had been Everett Ferguson, who is a Bible-believing Christian, And so it certainly helped to keep the focus on genuine Christianity and what it's all about. But the woman who was the president at the time of this conference in 1999, who was a professor at Duke University, obviously her views were quite different from that of a Bible-believing Christian. And the paper that she presented pretty well was the present position of patristic scholars in general on early Christianity. And that is, all of the history that we read in Eusebius and the other early Christian writings is all something we can't believe. Now, the traditional view, which is based on the rather obvious historical evidence, is that there was an authentic man named Jesus Christ who taught the things that are recorded in the four Gospels, that he selected the 12 apostles and other disciples, that they carried on Christianity after him, that Christianity was in the form that we read about in the book of Acts and in the letters of Paul and the other apostles, and that after the apostles died, Christianity was carried on by men like Polycarp and Ignatius and Justin Martyr, etc., the writings that we read, all of which is described in the history written by Eusebius in the early part of the 4th century. But what these so-called scholars are saying now is, no, that's not the way it was at all. We don't even know who Jesus was or what he taught. What you had were a bunch of conflicting views, and each one had the right to be called authentic Christianity. And so Gnosticism, rather than being a heresy, was a legitimate form of Christianity that had just as much right to be called Orthodox as was this other form. And that the other form, the form that we all know as Christianity, simply won out in the end, was able to suppress all of its opponents, and particularly once it was adopted by Constantine. And so it's written the history as though it was really the one true form of Christianity that existed from the beginning. And the address this professor was given went on to just ridicule the old view, how naive we were to actually believe the book of Acts and to actually believe Eusebius and Irenaeus and Polycarp and all of these people. Now, I'm not a professor at any university, but as an attorney, I do know how to examine evidence. And I think the historical evidence would convince any impartial jury that the traditional view is in fact correct, that Christianity started off as a unified religion with a clear doctrinal teaching, but that over time, various heresies like the Gnostics sprung up with novel doctrines. If Gnosticism was an alternative form of Christianity, how come none of the Gnostics wrote apologetics? How come all of the apologetics that we have were written by what are known as Orthodox Christians today? How come there were no Gnostic martyrs? How come they weren't the ones who were persecuted for the faith? How come they weren't the ones who spread Christianity throughout the whole world? No, the facts fit exactly what we read in Eusebius and in the New Testament and in the writings of the pre-Nicene Christians, that there was a genuine, authentic form of Christianity that Jesus handed to his apostles and that they spread throughout the world during their lifetime and founded churches that taught this same thing. When he argued against the Gnostics, Tertullian pointed to the fact that the churches that were founded personally by the apostles all taught the same thing, and they knew nothing about what the Gnostics were babbling about. And he could point to the fact that the Orthodox churches all taught one and the same faith, where the heretics, there were a jillion varieties of them. The Gnostics couldn't agree among themselves. There were many different schools of thought among the Gnostics with conflicting accounts of how the universe got here and what we have to do to be saved. But the real reason these people are attacking the traditional view is they have no faith themselves. They don't believe in the scriptures. They don't believe in Jesus Christ, in any kind of eternal reality. It's not that they are Gnostics and that they believe in Gnosticism. No, it's they don't believe in anything. And so they want to present a view of Christianity that will tear it down, like, oh, well, there are all these conflicting views, and this one happened to prevail, but if you want to know what real Christianity is, you've got to read all these other works, like the Gospel of Judas, because they have just as much right to be called Christian as any other work. It makes me think of a case we studied in law school of a man who was jilted by his girlfriend. He had wanted to marry her, and she rejected him. And so out of anger, he threw lye on her face. He and she were both black persons, and lye really creates a lot of discoloration. In other words, if he couldn't have her, then he wanted to ruin her for anyone else to marry her. Well, it's kind of the same way with these so-called scholars. They don't have the faith to believe in Jesus Christ. They're not ready to make the commitment that Christianity requires. So if they can't embrace Christianity, they want to try to ruin it for everyone else by portraying it as just being something that was invented as it went along. And that at the beginning, there were all of these conflicting teachings about Jesus Christ, and then one of them happened to prevail. For example, let me read to you an excerpt from an article interviewing one of the men who worked on the translation of the Gospel of Judas. His name is Marvin Meyer, and he teaches at Chapman University. He might have been one of the persons at the Patristic Conference in 1999, I don't know. The article says, Irenaeus had plenty of heresies to contend with. In the early centuries of Christianity, what we call the church, operating through a top-down hierarchy of priests and bishops, was only one of many groups inspired by Jesus. Biblical scholar Marvin Meyer of Chapman University, who worked with Kosser to translate the Gospel of Judas, sums up the situation as Christianity trying to find its style. For example, a group called the Ebionites maintained that Christians should obey all Jewish religious laws, while another, the Marcionites, rejected any connection between the God of the New Testament and the Jewish God. Some said that Jesus had been wholly divine, contradicting those who insisted he was completely human. Yet another sect, the Carpocratians, allegedly indulged in ritualized spouse swapping. Many of these groups were Gnostics, followers of the same strain of early Christianity reflected in the Judas Gospel. Gnosis or gnosis means knowledge in Greek, Meyer explains. The Gnostics believed that there is an ultimate source of goodness which they thought of as the divine mind outside the physical universe. Humans carry a spark of that divine power, but they are cut off by the material world all around them. A flaw world, as the Gnostics saw it, the work of an inferior creator rather than the ultimate God. While Christians like Irenaeus stressed that only Jesus, the Son of God, was simultaneously human and divine, the Gnostics proposed that ordinary people could be connected to God. Salvation lay in awakening the divine spark within the human spirit and reconnecting with the divine mind. Doing so required the guidance of a teacher, and that, according to the Gnostics, was Christ's role. Those who grasped his message could become as divine as Christ himself. Hence Irenaeus's hostility. These people were mystics, says Meyer. Mystics have always drawn the ire of institutionalized religion. Mystics, after all, hear the voice of God from within and don't need a priest to intercede for them. Continuing the article, Irenaeus began his book after he returned from a trip and found his flock in Lyon being subverted by a Gnostic preacher named Marcus, who was encouraging his initiates to demonstrate direct contact with the divine by prophesying. Hardly less outrageous was Marcus's evident success with women in the flock. The preacher's, quote, deluded victim, wrote Irenaeus indignantly, impudently utters some nonsense and henceforth considers herself to be a prophet. End quote. So this is the real reason for all of the hype about the Gospel of Judas. these professors and so-called authorities want to tear down authentic Christianity and pretend that, as I've said, there were all of these competing varieties and orthodoxy just happens to be the one that won in the end. You notice how innocently it describes Gnosticism. Meyer says, Gnostics proposed that ordinary people could be connected to God. Just reading the Gospel of Judas, I think, shows you how unattractive Gnosticism is to most people. And if you read the thorough descriptions that Irenaeus gives us of the teachings of Valentinus and other Gnostic teachers, I mean, it borders on the absurd. The problem wasn't a church hierarchy that the common person couldn't directly have a relationship with God, and so the Gnostics opened up the door for that. Anybody who understands true Christianity, anyone who reads the early Christian writers and understands them, knows that just the opposite is true, that Christ opened the way that we could have a personal relationship with Him and with His Father. We don't need the intercession of a priest or a hierarchy or any such thing. And that's what primitive Christianity taught. That's what Bible-believing Christians teach today. This person who considers himself an authority has got his facts all mixed up. He's confusing medieval Roman Catholic church structure and theology with primitive Christianity. And he's not being very honest to describe the Gnostics as mystics, saying mystics have always drawn the ire of institutionalized religion. That's not actually true. Catholic mystics are actually among many of the more revered people in the Catholic Church. And the Gnostics were not mystics in any sense the way the word is used in Christianity, because their God wasn't somebody you could have a particularly personal relationship with. He's somebody way distant out there, and you've got to go through all of these series of heavens to reach there, and most of them stress knowing these particular passwords that you had to say to the various powers once you died so that you could get past them and go up to the higher heavens above them. They weren't teaching a personal relationship with Christ the way authentic Christianity teaches it. See, these people can read the early Christian writings, they can read the New Testament, but they don't understand what they're reading. It makes me think of something Louis Armstrong said many decades ago. In case you're not familiar with him, he was a jazz trumpeter, probably the most recognized one in the nation. And one day somebody asked him, Mr. Armstrong, could you explain to me what jazz is? And his reply was, if you have to ask what it is, you'll never understand it. And I think it's the same way with authentic Christianity. Unless you are involved with it, unless you have a personal relationship with Christ, unless you have been born again and are walking daily with Jesus Christ, you're not going to understand it. You can read the New Testament, and all you're seeing are people, places, and teachings, but you can't truly relate to them. You read the early Christians, and they sound like fanatics. You can't enter into the same spirit that the early Christians had because, again, you can't understand it unless you're part of it. And that's why these professors can have so much knowledge and so little understanding. And because they can't grasp Christianity, they seek to destroy it by trying to create this confusion about all of these different gospels out there like they're on some kind of equal plane when they clearly are not. Jesus was a real person. He did leave behind real apostles who founded real churches who were there in the second century, whose writings we have. We have the writings of the apostles. We have the writings of the people to whom they left the church and the writings of the generations after them and the next generation and the next generation. There's an unbroken line of genuine, authentic Christianity. Gnosticism was a heresy that came out of Christianity that taught an entirely different message, and the Gnostics could never point to any church founded by the apostles who taught that message. And perhaps that's the reason for the Gospel of Judas being written. Well, yeah, the churches founded by the apostles don't teach this because the apostles didn't get it. Only Judas did, and that's why we have this secret knowledge that the rest of the church doesn't have. So again, the main reason this otherwise fairly insignificant work has been hyped so much is merely to impugn and malign Orthodox Christianity. The other reason is money. Not that National Geographic and the other institutions involved have necessarily wanted to profit off of the Gospel of Judas, but rather, understandably, they have wanted to recover the considerable sum of money that they've spent on it. You see, the manuscript containing the Gospel of Judas was actually discovered in the 1970s in Egypt. However, it didn't come to the attention of scholars until 1983, when an Egyptian antiquities dealer tried to sell it to researchers. However, he wanted around $3 million for the manuscript, but his prospective purchasers were willing to pay only $50,000. In 1984, this Egyptian antiquities dealer again offered the manuscript for sale, this time to a prospective buyer in New York City. However, again, the sale fell through because he wanted more money than they were willing to pay. So the dealer then deposited the manuscript in a bank safety deposit box in New York, and there it remained for 16 years, during which time it underwent considerable decay. Finally, in April of 2000, an antiquities dealer in Zurich, Switzerland, did buy the manuscript from this Egyptian. Now, we don't know how much she ended up paying for it, but after buying it, she turned the documents over to experts at Yale University for examination and hoping she could sell it to them. A papyrus expert at Yale realized that the manuscript contained, among other works, the Gospel of Judas that Irenaeus had referred to in his writings. Nevertheless, Yale University decided not to purchase the manuscript. Well, after another attempted sale fell through, the Swiss antiquities dealer finally sold the manuscript to the Maecenas Foundation for Ancient Art in Basel, Switzerland. And this foundation later teamed up with the National Geographic Society here in the United States to restore, translate, and publish the gospel. But it took years and considerable effort and expense to restore the manuscript to a condition to where it even could be read and translated. In fact, the entire process of restoring and translating the manuscript took 5 years. So the Maecenas Foundation and the National Geographic Society had a considerable sum of money invested in this manuscript that they needed to recover. So, of course, the best way to do this was to hype this rather insignificant document as some kind of spectacular find that sheds new light on Jesus Christ and on Judas. In their promotions, the National Geographic Society has referred to it as the Lost Gospel of Judas, as though it stood on a plane similar to the four Gospels in the Bible. Yet the National Geographic Society knows full well that this so-called Gospel of Judas was written about a century after the four canonical Gospels, and that it sheds no historical light whatsoever on the real Jesus and the real apostles. It only sheds light on what was believed by this small Gnostic sect called the Cainites. Today, the original hoopla about the Gospel of Judas has already faded considerably, and it will fade even more as people actually read this work and see for themselves that it's hardly a credible writing, and that it provides no true historical insight about Jesus. But there will probably be other Gnostic Gospels discovered in the future. After all, the Gnostics wrote dozens and dozens of fake Gospels. The only true value of their fake Gospels is to learn more about what the Gnostics were teaching. Although for the most part, Irenaeus has already told us in detail what they believed. And the Gnostic manuscripts that have been discovered so far have corroborated the descriptions of their beliefs that Irenaeus gave us in his work entitled Against Heresies. Everything he wrote is true and accurate. Nevertheless, in a further effort to tarnish and denigrate Christianity, and in an effort to recover their costs, the buyers of such future manuscripts will probably proclaim that they have made some remarkable new discovery that sheds new light on Christianity. But authentic Christianity survived the Gnostic threat in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, and it will survive the new threat from rediscovered Gnosticism today. After all, Jesus founded his church on a rock, and nothing can successfully stand against it.